Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacy Toth of PaleoParents.com and author of two paleo cookbooks. The first, Eat Like Dinosaur, kid-friendly gluten-free recipe and guidebook, and Beyond Bacon, recipes that respect the whole hog.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne, also known as the Paleo Mom. I have a background in medical research, and I love to write approachable explanations of the whys behind the paleo diet. I'm also the author of two upcoming books, The Paleo Approach, which is a complete guide to managing autoimmune disease using diet and lifestyle, and the companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. All right, so this week on the Paleo View, we have finally hunted down Denise Minger, and we're so excited, Denise, to have you on the show this week. Welcome to the Paleo View.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Denise and I met 2.5 years ago, is that right?
I think that's about it, yeah.
One and a half,
because Wesley wasn't one, he was two, so yeah. One and a half years ago... On the low carb cruise, and I, like many other people on the interwebs, thought that maybe Denise wasn't actually real, and that she could not possibly be as gorgeous and smart and funny and all the things that she appears to be online. But she is, so I'm super excited to share you with our listeners, Denise. And before we kind of get into it, I want to just let people know that they can find out more about you at your website, rawfoodsos.com, which I love, and I would love for you to tell people why that is the name of your website.
Sure.
And your brand new book, Death by Food Pyramid, which we'll be talking about, is available, I'm assuming, in all bookstores, but I know definitely on Amazon, and we'll get links in the show notes for people. But we are having you on the show to talk a little bit about that, but mostly because it's a really awesome excuse to talk to you and have you on the show. I think you're an awesome voice in the community, and I love what you've done with your time in the last couple of years. So super excited to have you. Thanks for being on, Denise.
Aww, thank you so much for all those nice things that you just said. You saved my day.
Yeah. Stacey just like totally said all the nice things, and I the only thing I have to say, I mentioned this actually on the podcast last week, is I love Death by Food Pyramid. It is probably my favorite nonfiction book I have ever read, and now that I'm a blogger, I read a lot of nonfiction. I just have devoured it, and you know, to the point where I found myself like I would take it into the bath with me. Like, it was my relaxation reading. Like, it's just been such a joy. And I hope you have plans to make a documentary based on this book, because there's so much of it that, to me, I see all the visuals. It just reads that way. And I just think it's such an awesome, awesome story. And I really hope that every single person who listens to this podcast goes out and get this book. It's just full of the most interesting history, the most astute analysis, and then not just that, but the information that people need to be able to evaluate information for themselves and figure out what is, you know, good science and good information to sort of assimilate into their lives, and what, you know, really isn't. And it's just, I've just enjoyed it. The Denise, your voice in it is just like, it was just a fun read. I mean, it's not just that it's full of really amazing information, but it was just a pleasure to read. I really can't speak highly enough of this book. I don't blather on about books like this very often. I really loved it. I'm like waving it around and showing everybody right now, which is like really silly on a non-video podcast. But just so everyone can, if you can hear me hand talking right now, there's a book in my hands.
Holy smokes, I think I love you. That was incredibly nice. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And thank you for taking the time to read it, too. I know it's took a long time to write, and I'm just happy that it's existing now out in the world.
Yeah, I remember when I talked to you on the low carb cruise,
yeah,
you were past your deadline for the book to be turned in.
That was a year and a half ago.
Exactly. So when we got the email from your publisher that it was like finally coming out, I was so excited. I'm like, yeah. Oh, I heard Denise talk about this book a long time ago.
As someone who also takes deadlines with a very large grain of salt, I totally understand where that's coming from.
Yeah. It's a lot different to writing a book than writing a blog post. And that's a lesson I had to learn many times over while working on this thing.
It's fun, though. I really like the medium of a book. I actually found that I really warmed into the ability to follow concepts much farther out than I would have in a blog post and actually take an argument to not just the first conclusion, but the second and the third and the fourth, and then bring in the tangents. And that's not something that's particularly easy to do with a blog post.
Right.
Well, if you want people to read it anyways.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So the words, yeah.
So Denise, why don't you kind of give your elevator pitch, as I like to call it, to people about kind of, if they knew nothing about you, who you are, why you started your blog, what the infamous thing is that made you recognizable in the community the first time, and then what your intentions were with Death by Food Pyramid. Would you mind giving me overview there?
I will pitch away. Yeah, so basically I started getting into the whole nutrition and health world when I was 7 years old after I went vegetarian by choice. And my parents thought it was a phase, and it was kind of triggered by almost choking on a piece of steak at one point. And I just became really phobic of anything with the meat texture. So after that, I just stopped eating meat, and I, just rejected any of the meat foods that would land on the table. And that continued for about 10 years before I ended up becoming an omnivore again. But basically, so I was vegetarian from the age of 7 to 17. But then when I was 11, I was diagnosed with a wheat allergy. And anyone who has a wheat allergy who has to avoid gluten or whatever, you know that wheat is in almost everything that's packaged and everything that is delicious. And so at that point in time, I had to start learning how to read food labels and just, for my own well-being and my own health, avoid things with wheat in them. And shortly after that, I became diagnosed with a soy allergy and a dairy allergy. And at that point, almost everything was off my plate in terms of what I could eat. And so I became interested in veganism and raw veganism. And when I was 16, I became a raw vegan. And it wasn't just any kind of raw vegan. I was what's called an 80-10-10 raw vegan, high fruit, low fat, where basically you're eating nothing but fruits and greens and maybe like a few almonds each day, or you try to keep your fat percent under 10% of your calories. So as a 16-year-old trying to eat this diet, partially because I was very ill already and I was trying to fix my body, and partially because I was convinced at that point in time that this was the optimal diet for humankind because, it's what the chimps kind of eat and they're our closest relatives. And, I heard all sorts of arguments on the internet that I adopted at that point in time. After 1 year of eating that way, I ended up with 16 cavities. I weighed like probably 95 pounds. I had absolutely no muscle mass left on my body. My hair was falling out. I had the worst brain fog to the point where I remember taking the SAT and like not being able to remember the end of a sentence after reading the first part of it. Like I just remember staring at this test, trying to do a good job on it and not even being able to comprehend the questions because my brain was functioning. Yeah, it was horrible. I always wonder like what I would have gotten on it if I was a raw vegan.
Presumably you could retake it or something.
Yeah, I'm over that. So anyway, I was a complete mess after that 1 year. And at that point in time, I realized, well, okay, I've been listening to all these people on the internet who seem to have, like medical degrees or something. They're telling me that they're experts on these things. And they're giving me this version of human health and human biology and anthropology and evolution that I took just hook, line, and sinker. I didn't question it at the time because I had no background and I had no reason to question the claims that these people were putting out on the internet. And after seeing what that did to my health, just listening to these people who actually knew absolutely nothing about what they were talking about, but just pretended they did because it was the internet, I realized it's actually a very dangerous place to be out in the internet trying to find health information, and it's just so easy to fall into different traps that will ultimately just make your health worse. So I started my blog a few years after I abandoned raw veganism. I ended up diving like almost headfirst into a pile of salmon sashimi at like a school potluck when I was 17 or 18.
That's the way to do it.
No, that's the way to do it. Trust me. Yes, please. It was my gateway drug food. And so that was after I felt ate that and just felt amazing afterwards. I realized my body was really missing something and that it was in animal products. So having gone through that experience, I decided to write a blog, rawfoodsos.com, just throwing out this life preserver into the sea of other failing and struggling raw vegans who were going through the same thing I was going through, but didn't have access to actual, like, legitimate information. And so I was figuring, you know, I spent a lot of time and I still kind of do debating people online. And there was a while where I had very, I won't say I was a troll, but I had a very aggressive streak where I was going on to vegan forums, raw vegan forums, and sharing my story and trying to help these people who were complaining of getting cavities and all their, you know, their health messes. And I kept getting banned because, you know, people don't want to hear that when you're vegan. And, you know, I was probably a little too aggressive with it anyway. But anyway, so I kept getting banned, but I really wanted to help people and share my story. So I was like, I'm just going to make a blog where nobody can kick me off. So that's what I did. And I started rawfoodsos.com as a way to help struggling raw vegans. And that was my prime intention with that blog when I first started it. And so for the first few months, I just wrote some very small articles on these topics that had been floating around in my head and that I'd been witnessing and that were aggravating to me. And I just wanted to get them out there online somewhere. And, you know, the raw vegan community is already fairly small. And then within that, the people who are actually willing to listen to omnivores who are ex-raw vegans is even smaller. So my blog readership was like 5 people. And I still think it was mostly just my mom on different computers. Okay, over and over and over, because that's what she does. I love you, Mom. So anyway, I didn't have any expectations that my blog would take off or anything, or, you know, it was just kind of a side project. It was kind of for my own personal release, just to feel like I was contributing something back to the world after doing a lot of research on my own and just wanting people to have access to the things I had learned. So I started that blog, and a few months into it, again, I was still kind of debating and arguing with people online, and there was this one book that kept coming up in conversation anytime I would share my story and talk about how animal foods had restored my health, and that is the China Study. And it's technically the vegan Bible in terms of scientific arguments supporting veganism and blaming animal foods for basically everything that can go wrong with the human body. And so anytime I would, you know, start talking about animal foods in a positive light, somebody would come out of the internet woodwork waving this book around and saying, well, just read the China Study because your argument is invalid, blah, 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 read this book. And I'm a person who really gets annoyed when people just end an argument with that way, like, just read this and, you know, no further questions. Because I want it to be. I want to, you know, actually exchange ideas and learn and grow and share information. So after, you know, the 80th time of somebody saying, just read the China Study, just read the China Study, just read the China Study, I was like, well, I'm going to not only read the China Study again, because I had actually read it, I think, a few years prior. I was like, well, I'm going to actually look at this guy's data and dive into this book and see if his claims in it are actually legitimate, because it didn't add up with my own health history, my own health experience, and it definitely didn't add up to what I knew about human evolution and biology and the foods that we've been eating for a very long time. So I ended up taking about 2 to 3 months. I acquired this book called Diet, Lifestyle, and Mortality in Rural China, which is 900 pages of numbers that the China Study book is based upon. It's like the original study. And so it has all these pages and pages and pages of numbers, beautiful, glorious numbers, which I love because I'm a nerd. And so I spent 3 months maybe just kind of passing out on my desk each night, reading this book, calculating my own statistics on it, and just comparing what the actual raw data said with what the author of this book, T. Colin Campbell, had said that the data was conveying, basically, you know, trying to see if his interpretation of it was correct. And so after just poring over this thing for the longest time and getting really, really, like, freakishly obsessed with it, I came to the conclusion that all the stuff he was saying was very carefully cherry-picked out of this giant mess of numbers, and that the best I can guess is that he approached the study with preconceived notions, with his own expectations based on his own research history and his own beliefs. And he knew what he wanted to find, and in a study this large, he was able to find it. So what he ended up doing was he very selectively picked things out of the data, spun together this argument that animal protein in particular spurs cancer growth and causes heart disease, causes osteoporosis, causes diabetes, just causes all these things. And So I wrote this critique of his book and of his interpretation of the study that I had just spent so much time looking over myself. And it was a very, very, very long critique, very long. And I put it online, you know, expecting my mom to read it and hit refresh a whole bunch so that it looked like I lost issues. And what ended up happening is it went viral overnight almost after I sent it to a few bloggers, in particular a guy named Richard Nikolai, who has a blog, FreeTheAnimal.com. And I don't know what kind of magic he worked, what kind of voodoo he has up his sleeve, but he made that thing go viral just all over the place. And my blog went from having, you know, maybe 80 visitors a day to, I think it was about 20,000 over in the span of 24 hours. And so I woke up, you know, a few mornings after writing this critique, and I looked at my WordPress stats, and the little bar that shows how many visitors you have, like, it was, you know, tiny, 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 tiny. Whoosh, looks like a giant skyscraper. And I was like, wow, there must be a glitch or something. And so, but no, it went, it just started circulating all over the paleo community, and it was kind of overwhelming. But I ended up getting into back and forth with the author himself once he got wind of the critique that I had posted, and that was fun in certain ways, and also very frustrating to others. But yeah, so at that point, I kind of decided that my blog, I wanted to steer the direction more into the way of just battling bad science wherever it appears within the nutrition community, rather than just focusing on raw vegans, because suddenly there's this platform and people were reading my blog, and I was like, I really want to do something with this. So that's why it has that name that's kind of outdated, and I'll probably change at some point. But that's how it all started.
Cool. Sarah, did you know all that? I knew all that, which is why I asked.
Yeah, I did actually. You know, the first time I ever heard Denise's name was in reference to the China study. And it was at a time when my blog was just starting to take off. And I was having a lot of people say, but what about Forks Over Knives? And what about the China study? And I had seen Forks Over Knives, and I had, you know, enough sort of wherewithal to know that there was, you know, there, that argument was very cherry-picked studies. And because I am like a PubMed geek, so I knew just how much conflicting information there was, that the overwhelming amount of information out there conflicted with what they were presenting in that documentary. And I think it was on Chris Kresser's website, where he said something like, since Denise Minger has done such an amazing job critiquing the China study, I don't feel like I have to. I was like, let me just take Google Denise Minger China study. And that was how I found it. And I was like, well, here it is. And then from then on, whenever I get asked the question about the China study, I said, well, you need to read Denise Minger's blog post about this, because there's like nothing else to say. It is the most sort of comprehensive analysis. And I would love to hear more about your interactions with T. Colin Campbell, because that just, to me, like I didn't know that you'd actually had a back and forth with him afterwards.
Yeah, that was the fun part. That was like fun. But I was like riding on adrenaline for like a month straight. It was crazy. Yeah. So what happened? Sorry. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, I noticed he hasn't sort of publicly recanted any of his statements.
Oh no, he won't. No. I mean, it's just the fact that he responded at all was very fun. I think just to get that the kind of acknowledgement that something you created caught the attention of the person you're critiquing. It's pretty awesome. But yeah, so basically what happened was, so I posted this thing, it went viral, and then there's this guy who has a website at Tynan.com. His name is Tynan Smith, and he's a blogger, kind of like a self-help, self-improvement. He has a very cool blog, actually. And at the time, he was a vegan. And so when he came across my blog post, he had a lot of questions about it. And so what he did was he actually emailed it to T. Colin Campbell, the author of this book, and asked him, you know, like, what do you think about this? Are any of these claims that she's making valid? And so the first reply that Campbell ever sent was a reply to this guy, Tynan, which he published on his blog, and it's still up if you do a little Googling. And it was kind of hilarious, because his whole thing was, I do not believe that a young female could do this independently and on her own without, you know, background in medicine or science or whatever. And so the whole gist of Campbell's reply, the first one was that I'm probably not a real person, or that I'm made up by the meat and dairy industry, like, to come out and get him. So it was kind of like this paranoid, very strange, kind of sexist, kind of very, it was very
ageist.
Ageist, a lot of ifs, a lot of isms in there. And
Answering the question at all, just attacking the source.
And that's who we should believe, by the way, as someone who is so non-judgmental and open.
Yeah, right. And well, he has the PhD, so that's why, you know, he's going to get the authority there. But yeah, he didn't like that I used a lot of adjectives. I think he was upset over that. For some reason, he thought that I used too many cutesy words and therefore invalidated what I said. So I read that and I was just kind of cracking up and kind of angry as well. Because I really, like, if he was going to reply, I want a debate. You know, I want him to sink his teeth into what I wrote, and I want to go back and forth and just hash it out. Because I love that kind of thing. So I wrote back. I wrote a public blog post kind of in response to the one that was posted on Tynan.com, just saying, yeah, I'm actually a real person. Thank you for questioning that. And also that, I wish he'd actually address some of my arguments instead of just brushing me away because I'm a female and because I'm young and because I don't have the same credentials he has. And I really think, and that's a big thing, it just really bothers me that so many of us will trust the PhD or the MD. We'll see those letters and we just assign authority to them automatically when, in fact, a lot of times people who hold those credentials are not always as trustworthy as we think.
Yeah, those really shady PhDs, let me tell you.
There's some out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just saying we shouldn't. Sorry. It's I'm a trustworthy PhD. I promise.
You can definitely. It just depends on what you do with it. You know.
Yeah. No. I mean, having been in academia and having, you know, gone through grad school and seen the disparity of standards. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. You know, both my parents worked in higher education. I've seen the same thing. It's a lot, you know, it's not a perfect system.
No. And it's very full of politics.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was the first reply that he wrote, back to me. And then I wrote another one back to that. And then he pulled out the big guns and he wrote like a 12-page response, I can't even remember now. It was like accusing me of using correlations without adjusting them and using the raw data. And, you know, for somebody who maybe would be reading this for the first time or seeing only his response and not reading my critique, it would probably sound very convincing. The only problem was he was accusing me of doing the exact same things I had accused him of doing and that I had done in a similar way to show that you can actually look at this data in from many different angles and pull out many different conclusions from it. So he, I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm biased because I wrote the critique and he was kind of my combatant in this whole battle. But I just feel like what he wrote had very little substance and really failed to address like the crux of the argument that I was presenting against him. So we had, I think that was the last time he wrote back. I wrote another response after he wrote his 12 pager and then he kind of dropped off and, I guess went on to do bigger and better things, writing more books. Including one like Low Carb Fraud, and then he wrote another one called Whole recently. Don't know if you guys have seen that, but it's out there.
I haven't.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm scared now.
Yeah, it's okay. It didn't seem to get too many great reviews on Amazon.
Well, I don't know that it would strike as big a chord to be critiquing low carbohydrate diets compared to sort of pandering to the vegetarian and vegan communities.
Right.
So one of the things about this book is that you actually don't talk about the China study very much. There's a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a completely different topic, really. And it's a completely same sort of critical analysis that you applied to your analysis of the China study, but you've taken this to really the development of, dietary guidelines by the government and the history of where those come from and the history of all the influences. I would love for you to summarize the research that was originally done. This was my favorite part of the book, and this is where I was like, okay, I'm hooked. The research that was done in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken, into like the first draft of the pyramid and how that looked and how different that is from what the food pyramid actually ended up being by the time it was released.
Mm. So I think, are you talking about the Louise Light staff?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a little bit earlier than the 90s.
Oh, was that the 70s?
Yeah, that was back then. It was, about a decade or a decade and a half before. So basically what happened is Well, first of all, let's zoom out a little bit and just look at the USDA's role in this whole thing, like from its conception onward. So the USDA was put into place in right around the Civil War times. It was signed into existence by Abraham Lincoln, and its mission was basically to support farmers, support agriculture, and disseminate information related to agriculture to the general public. And way back then, you know, we did not have these epidemic waves of heart disease and diabetes and obesity and cancer. The main causes of death at that time were things like deficiency and infection and diseases related to scarcity and food scarcity and shortages. And so it was actually in humankind's best interest to eat more food back then and to, you know, to eat everything that the agricultural system in America was pumping out, because that was actually making people healthier and helping them stay alive. And so back then, you know, the USDA's mission was pretty straightforward and it didn't have that many problems. And it wasn't until about World War II that our whole disease patterns in America started really shifting in a very scary way. And all of a sudden, we had better hygiene, we had better sanitation, we had better medical care. And so things like the infections and the diseases of deficiency were kind of on the, they're dropping off the radar a little bit. And instead, in their place, chronic diseases were rising. And so all of a sudden, people were dying of heart disease and cancer and these things that had really never before been a big issue. And so at that time, back during World War II, we had established a food guide system called the Basic Four, which was meat as one group, dairy as another group, grains as another group, and fruits and vegetables as another group. And there wasn't like specific guidelines with how many servings you should eat, and there wasn't a big focus on like micronutrient content or macronutrient content. There's no guidelines to eat less fat or anything like that. It was just like, you know, eat plenty of each group and keep stuffing yourself full. And so this guide was in place for a long time after it was conceived. And by the time our disease patterns started shifting, it became clear that the food recommendations that the USDA was giving out were not aligning with our new problems. And so finally a day came where the old nutritionist who designed that Basic Four, she was about to retire. The USDA needed a new food guide. And they hired this woman, Louise Light, who was teaching at New York University at the time. They hired her, and they recruited her. They took her down. They said, we need you to make the next food guide. We need you to do the research and figure out what it is America needs to be eating right now. And so she was recruited, and she was brought down near Washington, D.C. to work at the Beltsville Agricultural Resource Center. And she spent, I think it was about a full year, just poring over all of the available literature at the time on disease and nutrition, convening groups of experts who worked in agriculture, who worked in biochemistry, who worked in biology, who worked in nutrition, and just hashing out every angle of this thing that she possibly could. And her conclusions at the end were very different than what we eventually saw as the food pyramid. And she thought what would make humans healthiest, at least Americans healthiest, and not be a huge economic burden either, would be base your diet on fresh fruits and vegetables. 5 to 9 servings a day was her recommendation. To eat liberal amounts of cold-pressed fats. There's absolutely no fat phobia in her recommendations. She thought olive oil and flaxseed oil and you know, oily fish and those healthy fats that she considered at the time to be legitimately scientifically based, like good for you. She thought that those would be an important component of the diet. And she believed that grains should be limited to 2 to 3 servings per day, with 3 servings reserved only for the people who are super active, you know, or like heavy males who had a lot of, or had high energy needs. And, you know, used a lot of calories each day. And so she thought that 2 to 3 servings would be a good amount of grains to max out on. And they always had to be in whole form. She thought that any form of refined grain would be on par with sugar and things that we should not be eating, except extremely sparingly. And so what happened is she compiled this great new set of guidelines. She submitted it off to the Secretary of Agriculture at the time just to get it approved. And what happened was, instead of it getting approved, it came back to her looking like Picasso had completely rearranged the whole thing. And instead of this, the grains being kind of at the top of the guide where, you know, limited, very strictly limited, they had exploded to form the bottom of the food guide, the base of it, 6-11 servings a day. And at the same time, fat ended up getting nixed, and there were some other changes. They incredibly slashed down fruit and vegetable intake. It was only 2 to 3 servings a day total for fruits and vegetables that were recommended at this time by the USDA. It was only later at the urging of the National Cancer Institute, who thought those recommendations would be killing people, did the USDA expand that and say, okay, maybe we should eat more vegetables and whatnot. And so Louise Light, she saw this, you know, perversion of what she had created, and she was absolutely furious. And she told her boss that if this gets implemented, if this gets put into place, it is going to cause a mass epidemic of obesity and diabetes in this country. She said that point blank. And unfortunately, she was not in a position where she could actually make more changes at that point because the hierarchy was way over her head and the people in control and the people in power were far above her. And so she just had to basically abandon the project at that point, and the USDA took it on. And it wasn't until the early 1990s that we actually ended up putting our information into that familiar, iconic food guide shape or food pyramid shape. But the foundation was laid back then, and that was what ended up that was kind of the first thing we saw where grain suddenly took over our menus and fat became a villain. And, you know, the USDA's current recommendations really, we can see where they began. So, yeah, that was a pretty fascinating thing when I was researching it as well. And unfortunately, Louise Light, I was dying to get an interview with her. And as soon as I read her story, she actually has a book out called What to Eat that was published in 2005. It's kind of hard to find because there was another book that was also called What to Eat that was also published in 2005 by Mary Nessel that was a lot more popular. And so people Google that and that's when you find. But if you Google Louise Light, you'll find her book too. And so I read her book, and when I was reading it, I was just like, wow, this woman is a gold mine, because I've never heard about her story before. I've never heard this information. And so I tried to track her down, and I found that she had actually passed away just a few months before I started my book. I contacted some of her family and her former coworkers, and much of what she apparently went through, she took with her to the grave, unfortunately. And all I got were some cryptic messages from her daughter told me that, yeah, she actually, there were a lot of ghosts and skeletons that will probably never see the light of day, but that she experienced. And I don't know more beyond that, but apparently she witnessed some very heavy things while she was working for the USDA.
Well, I think that the way that she approached nutritional guidelines was exactly what has been missing forever. I mean, to just look at the, you know, scientific studies and to, you know, there's a ton of information, and to sort through it, there's a lot of conflicting information. There's a lot of places where the data just isn't clear, or we have population data, but we don't really have mechanistic data yet. And you really need mechanistic data before you can make a firm recommendation. But I think that that approach is like exactly the right way to approach guidelines. If you're going to have nutritional guidelines, is to look at the data and look at the, you know, what we know about, you know, nutrients. I mean, she had a very sort of nutrient density type approach, which I think is clearly the way, you know, we approach food as well. And I think that, you know, that process of, you know, looking at the science, you know, teasing out as many details as we can, putting together a big picture from all these little pieces is amazing. Like, it's just an amazing amount of work that must have gone into those original guidelines to simplify it to something, and to just have it tossed for, you know, never given a very good reason other than, well, poor people can't afford to buy all those fruits and vegetables. You know, that to me is like a complete failure of the entire system. And I would love to see sort of a reversion back to, you know, pull out her, that like her group's report and then update it with the information that we know from studies that have been performed in the last 30 years and then put together, you know, a set of guidelines from that. I mean, that to me would be so exciting. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but that would be so cool.
Yeah, oh, totally. And I think that if we actually did something like that, obviously our guidelines would look completely different than they do right now, because there's no way you can go through that entire process and end up with what the USDA has been giving us for the past, you know, 20 years.
Totally.
Yeah.
Stacey, did you just unmute?
Yeah, did I make people?
No, I was just saying, you usually unmute when you have something to say.
Heavy sigh.
I'm really enjoying listening to you guys. Absolutely nothing to add, which I know is going to end up being a blooper, but that's all. I'm like, I unmute because I'm like, yeah, I want to add something to this, and I'm like, I have nothing to add.
All right. Well, then maybe we can geek out about my second favorite part of the book, which was a really thorough discussion of you actually go into the whole book keeps coming back to the theme of where did our fat phobia come from? But I really, really love the historical discussion of Yudkin and Keyes and their different approach to what was causing the rise in heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to give the, like, the, I mean, this is obviously something that I think we could probably talk about for about 6 hours, but do you want to give the, like, the Cliff Notes version, just enough teaser to get people to be like, yeah, I have to read this book if they don't have enough teaser already?
Sure. Yeah. So I think maybe a lot of listeners right now are going to be familiar with Ansel Keyes because he's really the father of our whole low fat movement, especially hatred of saturated fat and our fear of it. He was, if we can trace this back to one person, it's going to be Ansel Keyes. Lesser known is his rival at that point in time during his career, which a guy named John Yudkin was actually proposing another theory, a competing theory, that it was not saturated fat causing heart disease, but that it was sugar. And so Keyes' whole thing, his journey started, like, he was just all over the place in terms of what he studied. He was, like, developing K rations for war, and he studied, like, marine biology or something. Like, he was just all over the map. But what ended up happening was he noticed after the war ended, World War II, that rates of heart disease were starting to skyrocket, and that people in obituary columns were suddenly dying of heart disease left and right, whereas previously in history we really had not seen that happening to that extent. And so he kind of turned his, like, scientific gaze towards, okay, why is this happening? What's going on? What's causing this sudden rise? How can we get to the bottom of this? And so he ended up looking at food availability data and heart disease mortality for a handful of countries, and he plotted it on this graph that became very famous among low-carb circles. You'll see this posted all over the internet. It's this little perfect upward curve of six countries where it's basically just correlated against each nation. You plot its total fat availability, and then you plot its rate of heart disease, and it forms this perfect upward curve where it looks like the more fat people are eating, or the more fat is being eaten at a national level, the more people are dying of heart disease. So when Ansel Keyes produced this little graph, he presented it at a conference in New York, and then he went on to the World Health Organization conference in Geneva a few years later, and proposed his theory that maybe it's people's fat consumption that is causing heart disease. And it was the first time in history that anyone had really made this argument, because fat had been for a long time completely treasured. Butter was its own food group for a long time in the early 1900s.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I know, right? And then, yeah, now look at it. But yeah, so people were very happy eating plenty of fat and had no reason to think that it was going to be bad for them. So this was very mind-blowing information, very status quo challenging information that Keyes was presenting. And unfortunately for him, he completely got laughed out of the conference in Geneva and went home with his tail between his legs, feeling like he had not convinced anybody. But he ended up getting critiqued by some other people who are in the United States who had attended the conference, had seen him, and who were also very skeptical of his theory. And what they did was they looked at the data that he drew from, looking at this correlation between a country's fat consumption and its rate of heart disease, and saw, first of all, that Keyes had left out quite a few other countries that were available at the time in terms of having data available. And he never gave, like, a completely clear reason of why he didn't include those on his graph, but if he had, it would have diffused the relationship quite a bit. And so these researchers, they went and they looked and saw, they went on a quest to see if there were any other variables that might be as strongly linked to heart disease as fat was. And what they found was that it was actually animal fat and animal food intake that seemed to be correlated with higher rates of heart disease at the national level. And I should point out right now that the data that everybody was working with at that time was not actual consumption of animal products or any kind of food for that matter. It was just a country's availability of that food. And so what we see is that nations that are more affluent and that have, you know, greater wealth, where there's less poverty, they tend to be able to afford more animal products. Whereas other nations that are more poverty stricken, they don't have access to those higher, higher cost foods. And so their diets tend to be more plant-based, they tend to be lower fat. And so all that was really being discovered at this point was that nations that had, greater access to animal foods, that were more affluent, that had more radio use, more car use, more television use, that had more processed diets, that were moving towards greater and greater levels of processing of their food because they could, those were the nations that were getting more heart disease. And Keyes had come across fat as a surrogate marker for that affluence, but he had no way at that time to actually show that fat was causing it. And so like a parallel universe was occurring kind of across the sea with John Yudkin, who was pursuing the same question that Ansel Keyes was, which was, okay, what is causing heart disease? And from his studies, he found that it was people eating more sugar and the influence of what that did on their hormone level in particular that was causing heart disease. And that was his conclusion, was that it wasn't fat, it was sugar. And unfortunately for both these men, fat intake, especially animal food intake, and sugar intake were incredibly closely entwined because, again, as a nation became more developed and became wealthier, it could afford these tastier animal foods and the tastier sugar-filled foods. And so there was like a collective shift in terms of diet where a lot of different variables were changing at once. And so both these men spent their entire career chasing their individual hypotheses and just hating each other with the most intense venom that seeped into their writing and into their exchanges with each other. And it's kind of funny because they both wrote books in which they kind of talked about each other in a very demeaning way. And ultimately, they both thought the other person was wrong and just wasn't seeing all the data. But after doing a lot of research into both of their theories, my conclusion was that neither one was right. They had both stumbled across a piece of the puzzle, but neither one had expanded their worldview enough to really encompass everything that was going on in terms of nutritional patterns and that relationship to disease. So they had a very interesting fight throughout their careers, and I talk about that a lot in my book. But ultimately, I don't think that it's fair really to say that either one of them was a hero or a villain in history, because a lot of what I'd read before I wrote this book was that Ansel Keyes was this horrible villain who did all this bad, like scientific fraud and, you know, deleted stuff and cherry picked and did all just like constant mayhem. And then John Yudkin was over here, the saintly angel who actually figured out the truth was that it was sugar causing heart disease. And after really, you know, plowing into this and trying to get to the bottom of it, I couldn't, in clear conscience, write my book that way. I had to be honest that both of them had their flaws, both of them had their strengths, and they were both basically two men who were very set in their ways, you know, who pursued theories that were not complete. So, yeah, there's a chunk of the book is dedicated to that whole saga.
Well, one of the things that I love about this discussion is page 120 in your book, where you reproduce one of John Yudkin's graphs where he plots radio and television sets versus coronary mortality.
Right.
And
yeah,
you see the most spectacular correlation. And, you know, it really, you know, I love that you bring this very level head to the discussion and the argument, because I've always heard the two sides. No, yeah, it's saturated fat. No, it's sugar. And I love that you go, maybe it's affluence.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the fact that both sugar intake and fat intake increase with affluence, as does total calories, as does polyunsaturated fatty acids, which you also talk about in the book, as does stress. I mean, stress probably has the best explanation in the scientific literature as a cause of cardiovascular disease than any diet factor.
Absolutely.
And to, you know, to look at the other things that go with this sort of westernized lifestyle. And I think this is a discussion that that you don't often see. You get sort of, I think, over-focused on it must all be the food, it must all be the food, and lose that part of the argument of, but look at all of the other things that go along with the food changes. Look at how much time we're spending sitting and how much time we're spending commuting and all of the chronic stress we have and how much sleep we are sacrificing for the sake of Facebook and late night TV.
Yeah.
And that, right. You know, these, it may not be diet or may not be diet by itself. And that you bring up that argument that, you know, it may be that diet's a factor, but that diet's a factor when these other things are at play. And you bring that discussion in just beautifully. And I love that turning the entire discussion on its head of, you know, we're looking for a diet cause of heart disease. And it's maybe that that's a stimulant or a cofactor, but that it's not the cause, and that there's all of these other really important aspects of human health that aren't even part of the equation. If you start with a hypothesis of diet is causing heart disease, I'm going to figure out what part of the diet is the problem.
I think you summed that up better than I did. Yeah, no, that's such a critical point, especially like if we apply that to people today who are reading this book or reading any book or just trying to fix their own health. You also see this stressing out over eating, which is kind of ironically like worsening your health in the long term because you're trying so hard to adhere to a diet perfectly that it's causing you more stress and just worsening your health problems. So I think it's important, yeah, totally, to look at that global view and just how everything is interacting. And I really think we have such a tendency to want an easy answer. Like we want to just have a pill to take and make things simple. And so that is kind of seductive when you enter the research world. As a researcher, you might just kind of single in on a single nutrient or a single food and make that your sole focus. And once you do that, then that becomes the center of your universe. And you start seeing how everything revolves around this single thing that you've chosen to be the middle of your world. And once you do that, you lose that big picture view where you see how everything is actually interacting and how everything is just part of a big web. And you really cannot just pinpoint a single food or a single macronutrient or a single micronutrient or whatever. So, yeah, I just love how you sum that up. Thank you.
That's right. Well, I mean, to be, you know, to present sort of the other side of the argument as, somebody who was a medical researcher, when you are faced with such a complicated system, the only way to gain insight is to break it apart into smaller, manageable problems that you can, you know, you isolate a single pathway of maybe, you know, four or five different proteins that are interacting and potentially binding to each other. And you evaluate if those proteins are interacting, what domains they are potentially interacting with, whether or not one's phosphorylated. I mean, you break these problems up into minute details. And that's why you need so many different research labs, so many different researchers with each, you know, their own grant money to take that one tiny little piece of the problem and to tease out those details. And what's missing in medical research is a system for putting those pieces together and creating a big picture. And that's something it's because the more we learn, the more we realize how complicated the system is, the deeper we have to go. And so it's a kind of a symptom of how medical research has developed, which is, you know, a really good analogy is taxonomy. So we started with kingdoms and then we went to phylums, then class. And every time you go a layer deeper, there's way more species. You know, eventually you end up at species and then you can end up at subspecies. And there's, you know, four kingdoms, but there's, you know, millions upon millions of species. And as you get into those details, you end up, as a researcher, you have to have tunnel vision to be able to contribute to science. You have to be able to focus in on your one little piece of the problem. And what's missing is the very, you know, you need people with multidisciplinary educations who can understand the research from all of these different areas and start to put the pieces together and find where the holes are, find where the conflicting information is. Because sometimes when you investigate a piece of the problem, you know, you can do it in, say, one model system and get an answer. You can do it in a different model system and get a different answer. And that's when you really have to worry about how that translates to humans. So what you'll often find in medical research is you'll find animal studies and human cell studies. So you might look at what's happening in human cells that are, you know, cultured in a petri dish, and then you would look at what happens in rats or mice. And when those two agree with each other, then you can have a pretty good sense that that is going to translate to what happens in humans. The problem happens is when you get conflicting results, and then you have to find new systems to test, because we just can't, you know, round up people and test a lot of these kinds of things on people without being incredibly unethical and
right.
So, and some of these things are just, I mean, some of the kinds of things that we do in, say, isolated cells in a petri dish, I mean, we just do not have the technology to be able to do that in an alive person. So, so to sort of, you know, give, I think, the world of scientific research a little bit of credit, it's a very unusual person who can pull data from so many different studies and create a big picture. And there isn't a system in place where those people are being trained or rewarded even for doing that job. So if a researcher does try and, you know, write a literature review and pull together, you know, these big pictures, it ends up just becoming another review article. It's not lauded as being some huge accomplishment to form this bigger picture. And I think that's something that there's going to be more and more demand for as we move forward over the next couple of decades, just because the small pieces that people are putting together are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and research labs are getting more and more specialized. At some point, there's just going to be this need that overwhelms the lack of people. Like, it will just, you'll end up just creating people who can do this job, and in sort of the same way that science does tend to grow and change and evolve and has changed over hundreds of years. Well, that was a lot of...
That was awesome.
That was me on my science high horse. I don't know where that came from.
Just from your perspective as, you know, someone who's been an insider there and has, you know, been able to see how that world works, I think that's incredibly fascinating. And it's so true. It's like we have this specialization that is becoming narrower and narrower, and it's like if the entire landscape is a computer screen, we each have a pixel at this point. And until we integrate all those pixels in a way that's much better than we are now, it's like nutrition's almost at a standstill in terms of where we can go with it.
I love that analogy.
Yeah.
Awesome analogy. Yeah, and I think that it's in part because of how research is done by individuals. There isn't an organization that then disseminates tasks. Mm-hmm. And it's good because then you allow an individual to follow their own ideas, and that's far more productive than if you were, you know, running basic science research like a company. But at some point, some kind of organizational structure that's not just the senior scientists who have more papers in Nature and Cell, that you're going to need that sort of the translators. That's what they are.
Right.
They're the translators.
Yeah. Well said.
Okay, so I have some questions.
Oh.
I know you forgot I was here, but I am.
We were geeking out together. It was fun.
It's kind of cute in like a librarian glasses sort of way.
Yeah.
And you just snorted.
I did. Because, I don't know, glasses makes me snort. What can I say?
Okay, so Denise, what are... Yes. The three favorite things that you learned while researching and writing Death by Food Pyramid?
Ooh, I like that question. One of the most interesting for me was when I was looking at the Mediterranean diet, and just kind of piggybacking off that whole Ansel Keys segment, he eventually kind of conceded his original idea that it was fat causing heart disease and decided it was mostly saturated fat. And so at the end of his life and the end of his career, he was promoting mostly a Mediterranean diet based on what he observed in Italy and Greece while conducting some of his studies. And so while I was researching the Seven Country Study, which was one of his landmark projects, I was looking more into the literature surrounding what he found and what, like certain areas in Greece that were incredibly long-lived, like what was causing or what looked to be behind their incredible health and their incredible tendency to live very long lives. And what I found was that, you know, we hear that they use so much olive oil and we hear that they don't eat a lot of animal products or that they eat a lot of like low-fat dairy or something. And the more I researched into what they actually consume, the more I came across information about their culture that was actually more pertinent to their diet than I originally realized. So back in Greece, especially these areas that are living very long or were back in Ansel Keys' days, the prevalent religion is Orthodox Christianity. And for anyone who doesn't know much about that religion, they actually have to fast from animal products, from oils, from alcohol, and from several other foods for about half of the year. Just, you know, intermittently, they do it twice a week and then for certain holy periods. And so for this big chunk of time each year, they're eating reduced calorie diets, reduced protein or protein-restricted diets, which itself has some credence in terms of extending lifespan, at least in animal models. And they're eating incredibly nutrient-dense foods rich in like locally picked vegetables. Snails are actually a huge component of their diet, and those are just chock full of omega-3s and a lot of other great stuff. And they actually fast from olive oil for half the year. So to ascribe their longevity to the consumption of olive oil actually seems kind of odd. But anyway, so I was reading more about this and their diet, and apparently this was completely overlooked in most of the studies that examined the diet of Crete and other areas around there that had a lot of very healthy populations. And so a big part of why they may have been so healthy was actually because of these fasting practices and intermittently abstaining from certain foods and just that whole cultural component or religious component and how that influenced the local diet. So I thought that was fascinating because that had not been something I'd ever heard when I was reading about the Mediterranean diet. And I think it's very important if we're trying to emulate like the Mediterranean cuisine and saying that's health promoting and trying to make that claim, you really have to look at everything that's going on over there. So that was very interesting. Louise Light story that we talked about, I think that was probably the most fascinating thing that I found while researching this book, just because it was so unexpected. I mean, I knew I was going to cover the political history of the food guide and how it got put together, but once I found out that woman existed and what her story was, I was just blown away. And along with that, I think the most interesting part was towards the end of my book. I talk a lot about Weston A. Price, who, back when I was a vegan, I just thought the whole Weston A. Price Foundation was evil and that they were just trying to kill people by stuffing their arteries with saturated fat and butter and all this stuff. And so, you know, I did a 180 on that as I became an omnivore again and did more research. But while I was writing this book, I had to revisit Weston A. Price's book itself, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, and I read the whole thing front to cover. Or front to back cover, and I was just so blown away about everything he had compiled, you know, so many decades ago, close to a century ago at this point, in terms of what these isolated communities were eating to sustain their health and to build extremely robust bodies and to produce wonderfully healthy children, and just to basically use the tools that their environment provided to design diets that could really sustain generation after generation after generation. And this part, as I was rereading his book, I was just like, wow, this was a gold mine. I really wish more people knew about this information and that they actually would go back and read Price's original book and not necessarily just read what was filtered out of it by other organizations, but actually read what he found. And just seeing how diverse different diets can be and still promote human health was very eye-opening to me. Just in terms of how I conceive of, you know, what the optimal diet might be. Because I really think at this point, there's a lot of different ways we can be healthy. A lot of foods that will promote health, a lot of food combinations. And many of us have this myopic focus on finding the perfect diet or one that's going to work just for the human species, like across the board and make everybody super shiny and healthy and fit and awesome. And I just more and more believe that's not a possibility and that the idea of an optimal diet is just like a unicorn. It's, you know, we might be chasing it, but it's really not out there. So that part of the book, just researching that and going back over the Weston A. Price stuff, really enjoyable, very enjoyable.
Cool.
I like
getting to ask getting that to question ask. And having you answer it. So can I ask you what are you doing now? How are you feeling with it kind of done and having your book baby out in the world? And
I'm sleeping for the first time in 3 years.
Sarah and I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, it's actually funny because I finished this book and I almost felt like, going with that whole birthing theme, I felt like I got some kind of postpartum depression because it was weird, wrapping your entire life around a project so intensely for so long and then having it be done and having it not be a thing in your life anymore. And then it's like, well, what do I do now? Because this was my identity. So it was kind of odd finishing it. And I actually felt kind of weird afterwards, like not having to get up every morning and immediately sit down at my computer and start typing. And once I adjusted to that, it was really nice just having some time to reconnect with people and see my family more and just, live life again for the first time in like 3 years. Since you really have to go on hiatus for a while if you're writing a book, it's just impossible really to maintain a normal lifestyle. But right now I'm just kind of doing a lot of podcasts and trying to do book promotion as much as I can, which is a really weird thing because I'm not like a self cheerleader at all. It's really weird for me to have to promote something that I wrote. I just want to like throw it out there and like go run away and have people do whatever they want with the book. So I'm working on that a lot, trying to get back into the blogging swing of things because I went like a year and a half without writing any blog posts, which I felt really bad about. So I'm going to try to get that back up and running. And other than that, I'm just taking a breather and just kind of letting the whole fact that I wrote a book sink in because it was always a dream of mine. And so I was very excited both for the opportunity and for that moment where it was finally done and published and printed. It's wonderful.
Well, congratulations. Sarah and I both know how you feel, although Sarah's baby isn't technically officially released.
No, I've got 8 days to go. I know, it's crazy though. Stacey, you don't have one yet, do you?
I have not gotten mine yet.
You should get yours tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading 500 pages of dense material for a review and having a week to do it.
It's only 432 pages. And I think there's almost 100 pages of appendices.
Woo!
So really, the main part of the book is only to page 339. I'm sorry.
That's a lot.
I'm sorry. So the reviewers were supposed to get like a whole extra like week and a half, but then the cold weather stranded the cover in Iowa, and the rest of the book was printed in Vermont, and they couldn't actually ship the cover to the rest of the book. So the two like pieces were like stranded apart from each other, and then it warmed up and they were reunited and found, and then they shipped. And I just didn't want to delay it anymore. So I just said, well, sad for the reviewers. The people have waited for this book for so long because it's gone through so many release date delays just because of our complete inability throughout the entire process to properly estimate how long the next step was going to take, because I've never written a book before and I didn't know what I was getting myself into. And Victory Belt has never published anything even remotely like this in terms of scale, scope, depth, or layers of complication with all of the various visual aspects. So I did want to let people know that the first print run is almost sold out, and we are going to the second print run. It will probably have started by the time this podcast airs. So if you haven't pre-ordered a copy, I would highly recommend doing so, because probably what will happen when those last couple thousand copies from the first print run sell is there's going to be a few week long delay while the book is on back order, waiting for the second print run to complete, because it takes 4 to 5 weeks to actually physically print this book. So it's been very exciting. It was nominated as an editor's pick on Amazon for the second time before it's even released again this month. And it actually was ranked number 275 on Amazon last night. Out of like the 20 million books on Amazon, I was just, I'm like, it's just amazing. Like, nobody's, I've seen this book except for the six people that I played scavenger hunt with on Saturday who found me in Atlanta and who I just gave books to out of the trunk of my car. That was really fun. And I will definitely do that again.
Which, but by no, the way, I'm both like creeped out by and think that it's awesome. When I like showed Matt what you'd done on Instagram, he was like, seriously? And he had this look where for a moment he thought it was crazy, and then he was like, that's awesome.
People who know me were very, very surprised that I would do that because I'm normally quite protective of my privacy. I only did it when I didn't have, you know, my kids with me, and actually when I stopped sort of abruptly. I'd planned on doing more errands, but one of my kids wanted to come with me for those errands. So I ended up stopping, announcing where I was, and I didn't hand out any more books because that, you know, that layer of privacy is still very, very important to me. But, and just for the people who have since asked, where will you be today? I will not be handing out books every day. It was really, really fun, and I will do it again. I've also agreed to do some traveling. People know that I've been very reticent to agree to do this because I have two young kids and a husband with a full-time job and no family within 3,000 miles of where we live. But we've talked about it within the family, and we've agreed that I can do some short weekend trips. So I will be doing some events around the country, and also possibly, not possibly, I will be doing some events in Canada over the next few months. So we're still hammering out those details, but just so that people know, I will be doing a little bit of traveling. And then the other
and
big...
I'm sure DC will be on that list.
Yeah, of course. And I'm assuming there's a couch for me somewhere.
Hey, we've got a whole bed. It's cool.
Sweet! So yes, I will be doing some traveling, and DC is on the very short list, short list. The other thing that I wanted to let people know is that, I've decided, that I just cannot, finish the cookbook now with the amount of, work that the book launch is taking and the toll that getting this book to the printer took on my body physically that I'm still recovering from. And I'm not at a place where I can push my body to those limits again. And nor do I want to. That was, you know, how sick I got in December was very scary. And it was a really big lesson for me. So we have pushed out the release of the cookbook until the end of August. And it's just because I am human and I only have so many hours in the day. And I really want to enjoy the release of this book. Like, I really want to, like, enjoy showing it to people and being out there because this is something that I really just, you know, poured my heart and soul into for 15 months. And it's, I'm so proud of it. And I want to be able to enjoy this now rather than hiding in a hole finishing the next book.
Which is how we kind of started the podcast with Denise talking about coming out of her hole and just yes. ago talking about like plugging it and enjoying it and, you know, kind of acknowledging that this happened. So I just think it's really cool to hear both perspectives of she's, you know, a few weeks / months behind where you are now and the kind of phase that she's in with it. And I think it's, you're a shining example, Denise, of how important stress is in our lives, which you probably know more than anyone since you researched it. And Chris Kresser was here last week. I went and attended like his seminar and did a joint kind of book signing thing with him. And stress is one of the things that he was, you know, really talking about as well. And I think is really cool about this whole paleo community. And one of the things that, like, I'm hearing you've incorporated into your book, Denise, and I know that, Sarah, you've incorporated into your book that the movement has really gone into lifestyle. And, you know, it's framed as, for most people, the paleo diet, and that's the Google search term, and that's how SEOs find the blogs and the information that people need. And I get that, and I don't have any intention, and I don't think anyone does, of changing that brand. But I think the idea of ancestral wellness and a healthy lifestyle is where we really want this to be. We want paleo, and I'm using quotation marks, to be the new healthy. You know, like right now, I think people hear the word healthy and automatically assume like low fat, whole grain is what I think a lot of people just associate with that word. And what would be really cool is, you know, if paleo gets to a place in its progression and momentum and movement where the idea of healthy becomes how we define paleo. And I think even further than that, it's awesome that, you know, while we've got this amazing momentum within the movement and people are coming to and finding such great results with it, that we're also sharing with people about how important stress is and sleep is and sunlight and, you know, nutrient density. And these are things that I had no idea about 3.5 years ago when we started in paleo and I found out about it. And I just think, you know, I hope it doesn't overwhelm new people when they start, but at the same time, I think it helps kind of understand the holistic process of what this all means and why it's important and how it really plays together about, oh, I see, this is really about living a healthy lifestyle in a whole. And I don't think everyone can take that on, hence why we just launched an ebook about how we think that it needs to come in phases. But I just think that, it's really cool that I think the books that I'm liking the most that are coming out, perhaps that's why I'm taking note of them, but the things that I'm seeing in the community that are really powerful right now are incorporating that piece of it, which is just so utterly important. And I found that out through regaining my own health over the last year. And I know, Sarah, it's the same with you. Yeah. When you got sick in December, you know, the first things that you focused on were sleep and stress management. And, you know, you had been eating nutrient dense all along, and perhaps you needed to clean some things up that went astray. But for the most part, you know, where it went awry was when your stress and your sleep got so bad.
Absolutely.
Then you started making worse choices.
And I can't even imagine how much worse it would have been if my diet hadn't been as nutrient dense as it was. Like, I think the fact that I wasn't hospitalized, I can credit to my love of organ meat and homemade sauerkraut.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to have, like, left you on for all of this, like, I don't know, frill at the end of our show here. Got sucked in, but.
I like it.
Well, we really, really appreciate you coming on. I know we have been looking forward to you coming on for a couple of weeks, and between you taking care of yourself and us having some other things that we needed to do, it didn't work out until today, but thank you so much for taking the time and circling back with us and coming on the show, because I think it was really awesome, and we welcome you back on the show anytime you'd like to come on to talk about anything at all. I just think you have such an interesting mind and you're such an added value to the community. So I want to thank you for that, and thank you for every person that I've ever referred to your site and your response. I myself, I think I told you when we met on the cruise, was a vegetarian for 7 years. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice to be able to kind of have conversations with people who say, well, I'm a vegetarian, I can't be paleo. You know, I know some questions to ask and I know how to start that conversation, and then to list you as a resource. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a question on the podcast about someone saying that a loved one of theirs was a vegetarian or a vegan, I can't remember what, and what should they do? And Sarah and I both said, they should get Denise Minger's book. So thanks for putting it in writing so we can refer people to it.
Oh, thank you so much for your support. You guys are both more fun than a barrel of monkeys. This is great.
That should be our new tagline. The Paleo approach, more fun than a barrel of monkeys.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
well,
awesome.
I've got a barrel of monkeys here at the house. So
I've got a couple too, so
yeah.
You can link them up.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Denise. And I look forward to seeing you again whenever that may be. Are you planning on going to PaleoFX or anything in the future?
Possibly. I'm still sorting all of that out.
Okay. Well, hopefully I'll see you around.
Yes, you will.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
And I have devoured your book. It is seriously my favorite nonfiction book ever.
Save it. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much.
Save it for the show. I mean, if you have a really loud fart and you don't want that to come out.
Stacey's just speaking from experience, as all.
No, I'm speaking from a household of five boys who think the fart jokes are the best thing ever.
You know, I have a four-year-old girl who seems to think that poopy jokes are hysterical, and if she just adds the word poopy to whatever she's talking about, it is the height of hilarity.
I mean, sometimes I just look at my eight-year-old deadpan and say fart, and he giggles like crazy. Like, he literally cannot control it.
Sorry, I'm not giggling like an eight-year-old boy right now.
Fart. Okay. Oh my gosh.
Denise has me laughing. Oh my god, I'm crying.